it has come to my attention that normal people with normal podcasts sometimes get into the habit of reading their email to their listeners. And while I can't really see the broad appeal of such an endeavor, I thought that I would share the overview because I can see the appeal of sharing. Anyhow, they go something like this. Hey, Miet, why don't you read some Richard Yates? To which I would say, check the archives. Or, Miet, how about some Heinrich Boll? Look in the archives, there's some that. Miet, little sauceport, read us some Georges Perec. Need I say it? Hey, Miet, I'd love to hear you read Felipe Alfao. Got me. Here you go. Good evening. It's Sunday the 31st of December 2006, and it's Miet's Bedtime Story Podcast. The Necrophile by Felipe Alfao. My true friendship with Dr. José de los Ríos dates from the time of the incidents I am about to narrate. Although I had met him some time before, it was not until then that I came into close contact with him. The incidents are as follows. Dona Michaela Valverde was a middle-aged woman who lived alone with a servant in the Barrio de Salamanca, the same part of Madrid where Dr. José de los Ríos had his residence. Not having any near relatives, and to all appearances very little interest in life, Dona Michaela concentrated her activities to a great degree on going to church. She went to early mass at dawn, to the benediction in the evening, and during the middle part of the day she always engaged in some sort of novena, or else in one of those cumulative series of prayers in which one prays one paternoster the first day, two paternosters the second, and so on, up to 50 or whatever the top number may be, and then decreases the dose accordingly, just as one does with medicines which are dosified by increasing and decreasing the number of drops. With these dosified prayers, one is supposed to attain practically any purpose which comes under the dominion of the saint to which they are dedicated, or the saint may be even moved by such perseverance to use his influence with bigger saints, or with God himself. These cumulative demands upon heaven were a specialty with Donna Michaela, but I have been unable to discover what she could demand so persistently and constantly. Donna Michaela Valverde was just as the reader will imagine her, but with the exception that she was not lean. Of course, her features and expression were hard, and she was pale. But she was not lean, and, as a matter of fact, she was rather well developed. If it had not been for her perennial black attire, and something more difficult to define about her, she would have come under the adjective of attractive. However, there was something about Donna Michaela that was weird. Dr. José de los Ríos called my attention to this fact. It was that appearance of a wax figure that no matter how faithful an imitation it may be of nature, is always sordid. Her clothes did not wrap Donna Michaela with a warm, soft caress as they do other people. They just lay on her with apprehension and coldness, visibly displeased by the close contact. Those clothes did not cover a resilient flesh that yields and adapts itself to its surroundings. They seemed to cover a stiff frame, and that reluctantly as one who complies with a distasteful duty. Seeing Donna Michaela, one realized that clothes sometimes have feelings. Aside from her church-going, Donna Michaela had another hobby, and this was to attend funerals. She just loved them, and was present at every funeral she could gain access to. As her acquaintances could not furnish her with enough material to satisfy her voracity, she was known to chase all over Madrid, looking at doors and windows, and wherever she discovered the slightest sign of death, she rushed in, and, under any pretext, literally forced her presence upon the grief-stricken gathering, often saying that she had known the deceased at some time. She uttered indelicate and tactless comments, gloating over the most repugnant details. She would say, devouring the corpse with her eyes, "How thin he looks! He must have suffered greatly!" "Why no, Donna Michaela, he had a very pleasant death, fortunately, just as if he had gone to sleep." "His features look distorted to me. His agony must have been long. Yes, this is terrible. I remember my poor Joachim. Yes, it was apoplexy, and he was all black in the face. It was horrible. I was like a mad woman and wouldn't let them take him away. Until the neighbours complained because of the smell. It was great. Terrible. Donna Michaela gave the corpse a last long look, and even stroked it if no one was looking, and then rushed to another funeral, leaving the family in a worse condition than before. She entered the next place with a professional air. "We have death today, I perceive. I am Donna Michaela Valverde at your service. You did not know me, but I was a good friend of hers. Yes, this is terrible." "It is very kind of you, Signora Valverde, to show this last attention." "Tut, tut, my child, it is a pleasure. I assure you, it is a pleasure." Donna Michaela turned several times about the bed or coffin, as the case may be, with a critical air, looking, sniffing, if possible, touching. "Did you stuff all her cavities carefully, my child? You better let me adjust that serviette about her face. It is loose, and her mouth is not completely closed. She looks like a person with a toothache, and not like a regular corpse." And Donna Michaela proceeded to adjust the napkin with a nimble, pale hands that matched the corpse, delaying the operation, handling the body as much as possible, and talking all the time. "I remember the time that my poor Nicholas died. I forgot to close his mouth, and when they carried him away it was wide open, as if he were still yelling from the pains he had before he died. These things are terrible. I shall never forget these moments at the cemetery when they buried my two poor husbands. I can still hear the sound of the first pail of dirt upon the coffin." And then Donna Michaela rushed away. "Goodbye, my child, and don't forget to call me the next time." When Donna Michaela arrived home, she was all out of breath. "Jacinta," she addressed her old maid, "5 funerals today. Very good day. Yes, I have not wasted my time." Jacinta shook her head and went back to the kitchen, silently. At night, Donna Michaela frequented the tertulia of an undertaker down the street, and there she spoke of death to her heart's content and argued long with her host. She could not bring him around to see things in her way. The undertaker liked death in a philosophical manner. He regarded it as a business question, whereas Donna Michaela considered it purely from an aesthetic viewpoint. She liked death for itself. However, they both agreed upon one thing, that there were not as many deaths as they would have liked. And they often held conversations like this. "I don't know what is the matter this winter. It does not seem to get cold enough."
"No, I have not heard yet of a single case of pneumonia, not even a bad cold." Yes, it is terrible. They speak so much about that famous breeze from the Guadarrama. I have not seen it do any harm yet. And with so many old people in Madrid, too, all they need is a little cold wind and... Yes. Very discouraging. I mean... Yes. Donna Michaela and the undertaker were good friends. She helped him in his business and he helped her in her hobby. She had become a most accomplished sleuth for death. She could scent it a mile away. She often said that she could see it in people's faces if they were going to die soon, and she often communicated these hunches to her friend the undertaker, and he made his preparations. On the other hand, he allowed her to potter around his funeral paraphernalia, and she had even seen him work on several occasions. Of course, they did not admit openly their mutual weakness, but they knew that they could count on each other's sympathy. They spoke of their pet subject in an unctuous voice verging on obscenity. "You know Garcia, the poet across the street from my house? Well, I know he is going to die soon. I never liked him, always reciting his second-hand poems about life and nature to everybody. He is already blind, and I know he will die. I could see the sign of agony in his face, and it is that girl, Lunarito, who lives with him. Yes, she is killing him. She is a beast. And those two big, gloomy dogs he keeps, like reincarnations of souls in pain. Yes, they have been howling at night. Donna Michaela loved death. It was an obsession with her that had assumed indecent proportions. She spoke of nothing else. She thought of nothing else, and people began to notice it subconsciously. She always appeared, as if by miracle, on the spot, and everybody began to fear her presence. There was that wax figure air about her, that cloud of horror that seemed to hang about her person. There was that deep look in her eyes that seemed to search for the corpse in everyone she met, that looked for the death that is latent in every human being. That drilling look of hers that penetrated the skin and caressed the skull, that boring look that reminded everyone she saw of the fact that his days were counted. That look which enclosed one like a shroud. She also walked in a jerky manner, as if she were a stiff mechanical dummy. With her black clothes at night in a lonely dark street, she might have been more than enough to frighten the most courageous person, and streets were lonely and dark then in the Barrio de Salamanca. And then I found out another important thing about Donna Michaela Valverde. She suffered from a strange sickness. Once every year, and for the space of about 2 or 3 months, she went into a state of unconsciousness which had all the aspects of death. It was something like catalepsy, but more acute. She grew cold and rigid, and all efforts to bring her to were vain. In the beginning, these spells were not so acute, and she could hear and feel, although she could not move or speak. But with time, they grew worse, and she lay exactly as if she were dead. Her features grew sharper, and set into a cadaverous expression, and when she woke up, she could hardly remember anything at all. By and by she was able to detect the approach of these spells every year, and then she went to say farewell to the few acquaintances she had kept, as if she were going for a vacation to the other world. By and by these tours to her friends became a ritual, which took place every year about the same time, the spring. And then she retired to her chamber, and her house was closed, and she lay dead to the world. Dr. José de los Ríos, who attended her more or less, said to me one day, Her case interests me, and I would like to know more about it, but she won't tell me. I believe she enjoys her condition. She likes to die periodically, and I do not think she really wants me to cure her. She innocently believes that we physicians are enemies of death. I know that she dislikes me decidedly, but it amuses me to treat her and threaten her with life. It is surprising how she hates life. She has the same repugnance for life that most people have for death. I mean, a repugnance for the obvious manifestations of it, not exempt from slight curiosity. She feels as revolted by the presence of a healthy-looking person as a normal being is by the proximity of a decayed corpse. She hates life. Donna Michaela Valverde had told little about herself to Dr. De Los Rios. However, she had told him that she sensed the approach of her attacks by the long spells of melancholia that preceded them. For almost a month before one of these attacks, she felt a sadness which assumed maddening proportions and almost verged on insanity. Then, as the attack neared, cramps began to steal all over her body at regular intervals, and she knew it was time to make her preparations. As I have said, in the beginning these attacks were milder. She lay motionless, but her eyelids quivered, and sometimes tears rolled from her eyes. She could see, hear, and smell, and sometimes even feel, but with time these attacks became more severe. She lost consciousness and was seized by complete rigor mortis. Her temperature decreased until she was cold, and the most sensitive stethoscope could not detect the beating of the heart. In that manner she lay for 2 or 3 months in her bed, in a room where the curtains had been drawn, having told her elderly maid beforehand not to give her any attention. The poor maid went about the house with supreme indifference. She had apparently become used to these things. She arranged things, put everything in order without even looking into her mistress's room, and thus time went by, until one day Donna Michaela would wake up and stagger out of bed, hardly able to walk. Then the old maid would see the door of her mistress's room open, and Donna Michaela come reeling down the corridor like a living corpse, mumbling in a hollow voice, "I've been dead. I have been dead." The maid shook her head sadly and went about her duties. Dr. Jose de los Rios had examined Donna Michaela during one of her attacks and had said to me, "I have made all the tests that science knows of for such cases, and I tell you that she is really dead. She dies for 2 or 3 months, and then she is resuscitated." "But that is not possible. It must be an acute attack of catalepsy or something like that." "I have made all the tests, and I tell you that she is really dead." Dr. De Los Rios insisted, but I could not be convinced. Soon there was a superstition about Donna Michaela Valverde, and people began to call her the dead woman. No one dared approach her. Everybody avoided her. Children ran away from her, frightened. The only people who continued to befriend her were her old maid and the undertaker down the street. And Donna Michaela went about lonely. She left her house at dusk and walked along the outskirts of the city, seized by infinite sadness and melancholia, and then she wandered in the direction of her church and spent a long time there in a dark corner, praying. Her sadness became more persistent, and she went by with bowed head. She cried often, and she cried more when she saw people receding from her. Everyone had left her. Everyone fled from the dense atmosphere of death which wrapped her, and when I saw her at that time I fancied that, during these periods of her life, her features had softened, and there was more of a human expression in her face. However, the repeated visits of death had branded her. Death had left with his deep footprints an indelible mark upon her whole countenance. Her complexion had assumed a greenish hue, her eyes were sunken and surrounded by black shadows, and as she passed by she left a trail of that peculiar odour which was not precisely unpleasant. It was a slightly rancid odour with a strong suggestion of withered orange blossoms, and it hit one's nostrils with a thud. And then there was that look in her great sunken eyes, that look that searched for death in everyone she met. But now that look, too, had been softened. It no longer had that former spark of mockery. It was only a long, sad look, often veiled by tears. Yes, there was a profound hidden beauty in Donna Michaela, and she might have been an intensely attractive woman. As a matter of fact, she had been married 3 times. Her first 2 husbands died, and the third one, called Cendreras, left her during one of her death spells. Dr. de los Rios, who knew Cendreras, told me that he left him the following messages for her. Tell her that I had to leave because I felt insanity close upon me. Tell her that I loved her more than anything in the world, but that love is life and everything with her is death. Tell her that every time I saw her coming down that lonely corridor in the house, I felt the chill of fear in my marrow. Tell her that she was beautiful, but that every time she embraced me, I felt as if my grave were closing in upon me. Tell her that our marriage was never consummated, that in the most intimate moments at night, whenever I approached her, I saw the jealous hands of her dead husbands rising from a black abyss to defend her from me. Tell her that in those moments her eyes were the most beautiful I have seen, but that they sent me away by their unearthly expression, that I knew that my intentions were sacrilegious. There was such a mixture of mockery and sadness in those eyes, as if they were reminding me that she did not belong to this world, and perhaps that saved me from a complete union with death. Tell her that during her death spells I roamed about the house like a madman, that it was like living with a corpse, and that every time she came back to life, if I made an effort to address her cheerfully because of her recovery, she looked at me with that expression of mockery and sadness, as if saying, "Do not forget yourself, because some day you will be stiff and dead." Tell her that every time she looked at me, I saw myself dead in her eyes. Tell her that I left her while she was dead, because otherwise she would have held me with her strange fascination. Tell her that I fled from that house of death never to return, but that I shall never love another, that she has awakened in me the germ of death which is dormant in every living being. And tell her that I will see to it that when I die my corpse shall be sent to her. And then Dr. de los Rios said to me, "Everything about that woman is dead, and everyone living with her would die soon. Death is a contagious disease that kills. With her it has become endemic and periodic. She dies often, but death cannot kill her completely. There is no better antidote for death than death itself. Anyone about her would have died." "But then, what about her old maid? She lives." "She is too old. She is no longer emotional. She has passed the danger point." "Yes, she is too old. Death has missed her. Like most old people, she will not die. She will just fade away." "And yet, Doctor, Donna Michaela married 3 times. After all, that is a sign of life, marriage. I understand. It's the consecration of an act of nature, of life, of love.
I don't know about that. Most things are consecrated after they are dead, and perhaps she felt that. She felt that marriage killed that thing which is one of the clearest symbols of life. 3 men yielded to her attraction in spite of that something about her that keeps everyone from her, and to these 3 she put the same condition of marriage, the same death condition. 2 of them paid with their lives, and Cendrerus only deferred his payment. He died not long after, the victim of a gruesome murder, but his body could not be sent back to Donna Michaela as he had promised, because only part of it was found, and this in instalments, and besides, the law objected.
But was she in love with her husbands?
I don't think so. What she loved in them was their corpses. She was in love with death, and I think she sacrificed them as a tribute to him. You know, I do not think she ever consummated any of her marriages. I gathered that from her 3rd husband. She was always true to death.
And one day Dr. José de los Ríos took me to the house of Doña Michaela Valverde, who was under one of her death spells. When we arrived, the maid received us. She greeted Dr. de los Ríos with affability and said, "There she is in her room, dead. You know where her room is." There was great indifference in her gesture, and her sentence rang with a broad, tragic humour in the lonely house. We advanced through a corridor illuminated by a window at one end which projected our shadows in our path. We advanced, pushing our shadows ahead until they met the opposite wall and began to creep upward. They rose menacingly before us, but as we approached them they shrank. At the end of that corridor was the chamber of Doña Michaela Valverde. The room was quite dark. I saw faintly the outline of her body upon the bed. Dr. de los Ríos circled around her and threw the curtains aside. The room was illuminated by the yellow light of the late afternoon. It was quite dismantled, with scarcely any furniture, and this covered with dust. The empty walls were dirty and showed cracks in several places. There was also a thick layer of dust covering the glass of the window, which was closed. This made the yellowish light fainter and colder. Doña Michaela lay in her bed, completely covered, head and all. Dr. de los Ríos threw the sheet aside and exposed the dead woman. We both looked at her for a long time. Her eyes were open, and in them the frost of death was evident, but they held that strange deep beauty which characterized them, and were surrounded by dark circles leading towards her temples, where they were lost in her hair, which lay dry and ashen on the pillows. On the wall at the head of the bed there was an ivory crucifix upon a black cross, bending over the dead woman with infinite clemency. Dr. de los Ríos remarked, "Her servant forgot to close her eyes this time." "They are beautiful," I said. And Dr. de los Ríos replied, "Yes, they are beautiful." I remained silent, studying her naked body. Then Dr. de los Ríos spoke again. "I tell you, this is death and nothing else. This woman has been dead a month and will probably be dead for 2 more." And he gazed wistfully upon the dead woman and recited in a melancholy voice, "The ominous thunder will storm the distance only to die unheard in the faint tremor of her eardrums. The scorching sun will surmount the meridian over her in silence, without extracting a single responsive drop of sweat to congeal upon the glaciers of her eyes. The dazzling stars of the nights will be put out as they drop like gouts of light and the absolute emptiness left by her soul. The blood-red dawn of the days will pale and fade upon her livid corpse. And the brilliant cavalcade of happiness will grow quiet when passing her and disperse in listless futility under the great, dense pall of her negation. And then Dr. de los Rios produced a bisutri and with brutal resolution inflicted a deep wound in her thigh. "Look," he said, and showed me the frozen wound without a drop of blood. "Touch," he said, and pressed my reluctant hand against her ice-cold flesh. I withdrew it quickly as another sad scene flashed through my memory, and then looked at the crucifix, whose head hung with graceful resignation. Dr. de los Rios continued, "These are not absolute proofs, but they are the emotional tests for the layman. I have taken the scientific tests, and I tell you that she is dead. When she revives, she will have no memory of her condition. All sense of time will be lost. She will think that she went to sleep a moment ago, but she will have vague feelings of what has taken place, a feeling that is unmistakable. She will sense the grip of death all over her like an echo. She is a specialist, and she can tell. She will say that she has been dead, and she will be right." "But this is absurd," I exclaimed. "If she has been dead a month, how is that putrefaction has not set in?" My sentence seemed to last very long. Everything in that room appeared to be in a state of suspended animation. We were standing at opposite sides of the bed. Dr. de los Rios had his back to the window, and I could only see his outline against the dim light. Everything was coming on fast, and the last light was concentrated upon the ivory crucifix and the dead body that lay between us. My sentence was still hanging in the air, as if unable to penetrate the death wall that separated us. Dr. de los Rios rose slowly, his outline growing into immense proportions that frightened me. The bisturi glittered in his hand among the gathering shadows like the last light of wisdom trying to pierce the darkness of mystery, endeavouring to reach and dissect the beyond. And then he answered, "Because putrefaction is the return to life. It is then that life snatches a body from death and claims it as its own. This woman loves death too much. She loves death for itself, and has detached it from all the intimate links that bind it to life. Through decomposition, a body returns to life, having lost its identity and personality. She wants to remain herself so that when she revives, she will know that she has been dead. She only wants the decorative and ephemeral part of death. She regards death only in its purest sense, separated from all its usual and necessary developments within nature. This is why putrefaction does not begin in her. It is too obvious a sign of life, and she hates life. But how she can arrest death, how her will can hold good past the boundaries of her life, is beyond me." And Dr. José de los Rios seemed to rise farther, his arm reaching for an invisible, fleeting truth. And then the light went out in his bestiary, and we were submerged in thick shadows. All I remember then is that Dr. de los Rios took me by the arm, and we rushed through the darkness and out of that house of death into the street. I never knew whether my experiences of that day were a dream or reality. I was busy all that summer and did not see Dr. de los Rios again until the fall. When I saw him, I referred to the subject. "I was finally able to diagnose her case more clearly," he said. "You know, Dona Michaela Valverde was in love with death, as I have often said. Of course, almost everybody has an interest in death, just as they have an interest in sex. It is the natural curiosity for the beginning and end of existence which affects them very directly. But this interest had grown in Dona Michaela to a love and a passion. She spoke and thought of nothing else. And then I learned from Dr. De Los Rios that she used to visit the morgue and spend hours at a time there, and also took lengthy walks in the cemetery. She finally discontinued her visits to the morgue because she was afraid to have her weakness detected. Besides, she preferred funerals where death had its decorative aspects. It was a real passion for her. She liked everything that had a suggestion of death. She liked dummies, and collected mannequins and all kinds of dolls. In fact, everything wherein she could detect a symbol. Dona Michaela was madly in love with death. Those death spells she suffered were, according to Dr. De Los Rios, the little trips she took to join death and celebrate her nuptials with him. And Dr. De Los Rios finished. I came to the conclusion that Dona Michaela Valverde was pregnant with death, and that the only cure would be to bring about an abortion. By the time Dr. De Los Rios arrived at this conclusion, Dona Michaela was already in bad shape. She was paralyzed, and her spells were now more frequent. She spent more of her time dead than alive, and death had got a terrible hold of her. And Dr. De Los Rios said, "Then poor Dona Michaela called me for a consultation. I already knew what medicine she needed. You know how I believe in suicide as a universal panacea. Well, suicide is also an abortion of death. Therefore, after she told Dr. De Los Rios all her troubles, he said that he could not cure her, and that her case was hopeless, and that the best thing she could do was to commit suicide. That death was the best antidote for death. Death would not come to look for her unless she went to look for him." Her reactions were most surprising. That woman, who had died so many times, had now developed a tremendous love for life, and the prospect of a temporary death, let alone a permanent one, as Dr. De Los Rios proposed, made her really furious. She insulted him and said that he did not know his business, that he did not like her, and did not want to cure her. Dr. De Los Rios was relentless. He spoke of suicide as eloquently and convincingly as one who does not practice it, and went away leaving in her mantle a gun loaded with blank cartridges. "And did the trick work?" I asked Dr. De Los Rios. "Perfectly," he answered. "It seems that she became so maddened by the approach of death, which she could sense, that in a moment of strength she decided to kill herself. When she shot off the gun, she fainted, but under the effect of a pail of water that her maid emptied on her head, she came to, feeling very well. She got out of the chair when she had been confined, and walked as if nothing had happened. And Dona Michaela Valverde is quite all right now. Dr. De Los Rios had all her collections of dolls, mummies, and mannequins thrown away, told her to move to a cheerful house, and forbade her to step into a church again. Dr. De Los Rios says, 'You know, this religious business deals too much with the beyond and creates an obsession with death. There are many cases in Spain like the one of Dona Michaela Valverde. Have you noticed those rows of fanatics dressed in black clothes and looking like a corpse that go to the benediction at dusk? Well, Every one of them has a more or less marked tendency towards necrophilia. Of course, the case of Donna Michaela was acute and verged on obscenity. She was already pregnant with death, but there are many others who, although they do not go so far, often flirt with the idea, and one of these days are going to get caught. It really was quite an extraordinary case. And it also has its romantic touches. Donna Michaela, drawn away from life by her passion to join her lover in the lonely paths of nothingness,